Get your daily market recap on the latest stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on iTunes, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
And friend, we start the show with a sad note. Former Bundesbank president Hans Tietmeyer, who was the last president of the Bundesbank before the ECB, has died at the age of 85, a statement out from Bundesbank president Jens Weidmann just a few moments ago.
Sad. 84 is still a good life, but you're right. It's sad, and actually, usually in the Christmas period, we do get a little bit of this always sad news when it comes to death. Away from sad news, Mike, and actually, I don't know whether it's good news or bad news, but you know, you were talking about the fact that we had a day off yesterday. We're still trying to figure out, and actually, I urge all of our listeners, if you like talking about Brexit, there's a great Brexit quiz on our Bloomberg.com, but we're seeing, as economic uncertainties may actually ratchet it up in 2017, a lot more people hoarding cash. So this is according, Mike, to the British Bankers Association, and it's the first time that we saw that personal deposits growing about 5% in November. I don't know whether it means that people are just a little bit concerned about their house prices and things like that, or inflation, but it's the first time we've seen it in 11 months.
And they got to pay their Christmas bills too, you know, all the money they spent on gifts, all the money you see. Yeah. I mean, when you say hoarding cash, I think of people putting their, sterling coins into a tin on the dresser or something like that. But
you know, we have a new coin in 2017.
Yeah.
One of the probably most popular cultural stories here is that we have a new sterling coin, which I believe will be unveiled by the Bank of England 2017, March or even April of next year, that strangely looks like the euro. It's true. I've seen it.
Perfect timing. Well, let's ask Mark Chandler about that. He's head of currency strategy for Brown Brothers Harriman, and he has migrated over here with us from Bloomberg Surveillance on television. And Mark, is significant that the Brits are introducing a new coin this year? Actually, the larger question is, what is the pound? What happens to the pound in 2017 with Brexit in full flower? Supreme Court decision coming up, the Article 50 trigger theoretically in March. What do you see happening?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. I think that's like one of the big surprises, of course, this year was the Brexit, the referendum. I still think that such an important decision made by a very small majority of people, less than 52%. So some big changes coming to the UK. And I think the market is getting frustrated that this idea of a soft Brexit, hard Brexit, which is what the market's really been debating about, I think next year all that changes. And it seems to me these are splitting hairs, really. It's hard to see how the UK is going to be able to maintain both access to the common market and control its borders. I think the EU is right that it's not a smorgasbord type of opportunity where you just pick and choose what you want. And so I think that until this is resolved, it's hard to see how sterling has a substantial rally. So I'm looking at sterling still to be falling. I think that next year, if I'm right about the euro going through parity, I think we could see sterling back down to those lows we saw around the flash crash, bring this down to about 114 or so, say a dime from here on the downside.
Fran, I'm looking at this new pound coin. Looks like there's a pineapple on it. I mean, what is that?
I think it's a Scottish emblem, but close. It's a thistle. It looks a little bit like a pineapple, but I think it's a thistle. We'll put it on social media for the people that are listening to us. So you can also have a look at the new 12-sided one-pound coin being unveiled next year. Mark, when you look at currencies, right, it's very clear that volatility was largely played out in currencies in 2016 because stocks just kept on going higher. Do you think we'll follow a similar pattern in 2017?
No, I think that's good because I think that what we have is that there's this idea that the capital markets, that letting the prices of currencies and money in general, like interest rates, move, be volatile, that means that the real economy doesn't have to be. That is that these financial instruments act as a shock absorber. And we've seen the economies become more volatile as the financial markets become less volatile. So I personally would rather see more volatility in the financial assets. So that the problem, though, with volatility in the financial assets is it implies a direction. So when we say low volatility in the stock market, what do we know? We know from some of the charts that Mike's shown before that the VIX tends to go down when the stock market goes up. So we're talking about more volatility. We're talking about lower stock prices. And we're probably talking about lower bond prices if bond market volatility is going to improve. Currencies are a different story. I think that some currencies tend to be more volatile. I'd say that the dollar block, Aussie, Canada, Kiwi, tend to be a bit more volatile than, say, the Swiss franc. But I think that in the year ahead, we still have to be careful about the yen, which has had this big reversal this year. You know, we began at 125 or so, sold off to almost 100, and then bounced back here to 117, 118. I'm looking for dollar yen to continue to move higher. I'm looking for this to take place over the course of the first half of the year. But the same thing, I think, in the other major currencies. We should be expecting a little bit more volatility, not just because of a trend, but really because of these periods of consolidation after these large trends like we've just seen.
We started the conversation with the pound, but you told us earlier that it is the euro is your currency of the year for 2017, that it's going to really influence what happens to a lot of the markets in the coming year.
Yeah, so the way I sort of think of this is that what's going on, I think that besides this divergence between the ECB policy and Fed policy, we also have political issues. And I think for me, the key to the political issues is this wave of populism, nationalism, may begin off in Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, move to the UK with the Brexit vote, the US election with the Trump election. And now we have in Europe next year, we have several opportunities for these populist nationalists to show their hand. And I think that this nervousness, this anticipation, it keeps the euro on the defensive. And I think that this is particularly problematic because Europe has been held together by integration. And if we're seeing a wave of nationalism, that eats away at that integration. And so this is an existential challenge for Europe. And I think that's what keeps the euro, besides this monetary policy, this wide divergence. Investors get paid over 200 basis points right now to be long the U.S. dollar over the euro, thinking about financing it through the Germany. This is the key incentive, the key driver for the dollar, but I think that the politics are right behind it.
But, Mark, aren't the politics extremely dangerous? And I don't know whether it's because we don't trust the polls, but is there a concern that actually one of the big countries, I'm thinking Italy, France, could leave the eurozone in the next 18 months?
Oh, I don't know about 18 months to leave the eurozone. Here's what would have to happen, right? Think about next year, we get the Dutch elections first, most likely. The Dutch elections and the far-right party does seem to be pulling ahead, but the majority of the Dutch want to stay in the EU, want to stay in EMU. Then you've got the French election, and there's a long tradition of the center two parties combining forces when faced with a challenge from the National Front. Even then, I can't see how it happens in 18 months. And then, of course, in Germany, where Merkel, she might not be as popular as she was before due to her immigration policies, but it doesn't look like she has a local rival that could unseat her. So you're right that other elections, like in Italy, it's possible. But even then, Italy has a constitutional ban on referendums to affect treaties. So I think that people are jumping the gun a little bit. You know, I was around for both of the Greek crises, and many people thought Greece was going to drop out. I think those London bookies were making odds at like a 7-1 or 12-1 chance that Greece was going to drop out. And I think that people have underestimated the political will. And that's what's so important about now. The political will is being challenged.
I thought Karen was rounding off, but it really is $1.400 for the euro, which is Mark Chandler's currency of the year for 2017. You think it'll go down as low as 82, 81?
Not next year, but I've got 97 by the middle of the year, but the 82.5 is the October 2000 low, and I think we're going to head there in the, during this Obama/Trump dollar rally.
Well, when we last saw the euro that low, the rest of the world stepped in, the G20 intervened to prop it up. Currency intervention has sort of gone the way of the dodo, but does it come back?
Well, it could come back, but I think that it depends on what's happening at the time. I mean, right now it seems to me that the weakness of the euro is a good thing for Europe. It's a good thing for the world economy because this is how it's supposed to work. The country that's growing quicker or has stronger fundamentals gets a stronger currency, and those countries that have weaker economies get a weaker currency that helps stimulate them. So it depends on really what happens when we get those kind of extremes and how fast we get there.
Right, but Mark, this is kind of the point that I was thinking about, is that a weaker euro will be welcomed for a lot of the European exporting countries. Mm-hmm. Is the problem, if you want to call it a problem, is not dollar strength?
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think that we're at a point yet where the dollar is a problem for Europe. I don't think the dollar is yet really a problem for the U.S. as long as the pace that we've seen in the recent months does not continue at this pace. So I'm not sure that we're at a point in that, at a point in the foreseeable future where the G7 will say, we've been telling the Chinese, we've been making these high-sounding platitudes at G20 meetings that currency markets ought to determine the value of foreign exchange, that to overcome those comments with saying that, well, this time is different, we need to intervene because the dollar is getting too strong, I think it's a very high hurdle bar. I don't think we're anywhere close to that.
All right. Other big currency of the year, perhaps in 2017, will be the Chinese yuan, because the president-elect of the United States has said he's going after the Chinese because they unfairly manipulate their currency. They obviously have been manipulating it higher, not lower, as he has suggested, trying to keep a floor under it. But what happens to the yuan in 2017?
Yeah, so I think that the first thing I'd say to keep in mind is that when it comes to people, you and I talk, we want to be honest with each other. But I think when politicians talk, they make a distinction between like declaratory policy, what they say, operational policy, what they do. And oftentimes, the U.S. presidential candidates talk tough about China. When they get into office, they realize they get presented with new information, the complexities of the relationship, and the nuances of what China is doing. And right now, I fully agree that China is if anything, it's trying to strengthen its currency. It does not want the currency to fall too fast. It's keeping it relatively stable against the basket. But because I have a strong dollar view, and I'm backed on Fed raising interest rates, strength of the U.S. economy, while the Chinese economy likely to slow, and if anything, some more monetary stimulus from China, I've got the dollar RMB, which now you say is right below 7, going to about 720 next year.
Okay, you're suggesting, Mark, that when the facts change or the facts presented to the president-elect change, he will change. What will it take for Trump's trade advisor, Peter Navarro, who's written books called, for example, The Death of China, who has clearly on the show also said he believes China is cheating because they have a surplus?
Yeah, this is a good point you raise. And for me, the challenge as an observer is really trying to figure out which of these voices within the Trump administration are really going to carry the day. I first got involved in politics when Henry Kissinger was a national securities advisor, and I think Will Rogers was at the Secretary of State, and yet it was Henry Kissinger that was really running the show. So it really depends not just on who the formal appointments are, but where that power really lies. And it's not clear to me how it's going to play out. One thing, though, is clear to me, and even though Trump has said that he'll declare China a currency manipulator on day one in office, I would not hold your breath for that. That is to say that the Treasury Department has a quantitative list of factors, and they say that China only meets one of those three factors. And so whatever brush the Trump administration says that China is a currency market manipulator, that same brush could be used to tar many other countries, perhaps including Japan.
Well, very quickly, what does it mean if they designate them a currency manipulator?
Yeah, so there's two parts of it. One is China would have to, whoever we cite as a currency manipulator, would have to have negotiations with the U.S. But more importantly, how it affects like equity investors is that U.S. companies could then sue China to get for their grievances that China's manipulated their currency, taken X percentage dollars from them. How do they respond? They can sue them. And so I think that it just opens up another can
of worms. The World Trade Organization?
I think there might be even separate judicial tribunals set up for this. I don't think it's fully just at the WTO.
All right. Mark Chandler from Brown Brothers Harriman, thanks for joining us this morning here on Bloomberg Surveillance. Tony Crescenzi is PIMCO's market strategist, portfolio manager. He's come home for Christmas all the way from Newport Beach to Brooklyn and points here in Manhattan. We thank you for stopping by this morning. Your latest note intrigued me because everybody talked about the taper tantrum. It was a huge impact on the markets when the Fed suggested it might raise rates and did not, might taper and did not. Now you're calling what we're seeing in the bond markets a Trump tantrum. But when you use those words, is it's not the same effect, is it?
It's a lot different. In 2013, there was this fear of withdrawal of stimulus, the ending of quantitative easing, the bond buying that the Fed had engaged in, buying several trillion dollars of securities. This tantrum is a little different. It relates to Trumponomics and more traditional factors that affect the bond market, such as growth and inflation. The markets think that growth, which has been subdued at around 2% or so, inflation also subdued, might pick up toward the old normal. I mean, the new normal for growth had been around 2%, but the markets think that it could pick up. The question is whether it'll pick up permanently in the trajectory move up toward the old normal. We're suspect, and the bond market, in fact, is, while many are talking about the Dow 20,000, all the optimism, look at where the bond market's priced for yields in the year 2020. Looking at short-term instruments, difficult for anyone to, the average person to see, but we in the bond market know that the market participants are priced for the federal funds rate, the Fed's policy rate, which is today at about 0.5%, to move up to just 2% in 2020. That's about half of what is normal for a neutral rate, where the Fed's neither pressing on the gas or the brakes, historically. So the markets still believe that growth will be subdued over the long run. So while there has been a Trump tantrum, it's been relatively subdued in the sense that the markets are still priced for a very benign, shallow path on interest rates looking forward.
Tony, first of all, congratulations on your greeting. Hi, Tony. I wanted to send you a Bloomberg message through the terminal. And as a greeting, I have, you are only as good as your last trade.
Correct.
I love that.
I've used since the 1990s on my Bloomberg terminal.
And it served you well. So yes. What is your best trade for 2017?
Well, for one, it's great news that bond yields have increased for bond investors, because starting yield is the major determinant of future returns. The yield on the Barclays aggregate, which for those who don't know, it's similar to watching the S&P 500. It's the main barometer by which many bond managers are judged against, although there are a lot of them these days. The Barclays aggregate is yielding about 2.75%. That's up a percentage point from about 6 weeks ago. In other words, investors, as I said, can now expect, with the idea that starting yield is the major determinant of future returns, about 2.75 in a passive strategy, but bond managers like PIMCO historically earn alpha and earn something above that, and we historically have earned about 100 basis points more than that. So bond investors are looking at returns in the high threes now and even near four on average going forward. So staying invested in bonds is one of the important points. It's many are worried about rising yields, but as I said, higher yields are good for one. And secondly, one can't try to market time the diversification benefits of bonds. It's like getting in a car and saying, well, today I don't need car insurance, I'll take the risk. It's not a wise thing to do. So if investors want to buy equities, if they want to take more risk because they feel the economic outlook is better than it was, owning bonds, of course, enables them to get in the car and drive and take those risks. So it's good to have that anchor. So staying invested in bonds, being overweight on credit, and also by being somewhat cautious and leaving some dry powder is another factor. And also by staying invested is probably the biggest thing I could say. There are a lot of little details, but I've talked too long about things to buy, but we can talk about that if you want.
Well, I have to follow up. By the way, John Tucker points out it's the Bloomberg Barclays Index, so we have to do our own shameless plug here.
Very
so
good.
Tony's writing that down. He won't make that mistake again.
Never again.
But how do I know? I mean, you don't have to go into every detail of every bond, but you say I should have bonds. You sell bonds.
Sure.
How do I know what kind of bonds I want to buy in the whole universe to offer myself protection at a time when, even if Trump produced zero additional growth, growth has picked up enough to justify the higher rates that we're seeing right now?
Right. Well, in terms of the types of bonds, the core strategies, for one, the anchor that I mentioned, the insurance that investors tend to need, the diversification benefits, the type of thing to stick with. Because investors these days want to take more risk, and equities have moved up significantly, and if they want to stay in the car and drive and take additional risks, probably is good to be in core strategies. But there are also good income strategies that depend on investments in illiquid and complex instruments. These include non-agency mortgages, subprime mortgages, for example. We would expect returns in those, and we've been investing heavily in them, to stay in the mid-single digits, call it 5% or so, on a loss-adjusted hold-to-maturity basis. Second security of high interest to us is a bank capital. Banks in Europe, they're getting safer and safer, maybe not those in Italy, but in general, banks are shoring up their capital levels, and that's good for capital securities, which are yielding between 7 and 9% in Europe. So we like those. And being overweight credit is a general concept, but leave some dry powder. If we had to put it on a scale of 0 to 10, how in terms of the overweight on credit, we'd probably place it around 5 or so, because markets are somewhat fully priced for a good scenario. And there'll be ups and downs naturally in markets in 2017 and beyond that one will want to take advantage of. So core strategies, number one, income strategies. Secondly, complexity, illiquidity, good things. Taking advantage of volatility is something to do in the bond market and as an investor generally.
And Tony, does that change, given what you've just said in terms of the investment landscape, does it change if the U.S. enters a trade war or something goes not to plan? I don't know if it's tariffs, I don't know if it's messy renegotiations.
Well, Francine, as you mentioned, the idea of the negative side of the Trump trade that markets don't seem to be thinking about, and this is why when we say stay overweight on credit but leave dry powder, we are thinking about the possibility of volatility in 2017 as markets now and then look at the negative side of, or the risks, I should say, the left tail risks for the Trump administration. And so those are things that can affect the market negatively and would add to volatility. And we'll have to wait and see how the Trump administration reacts to that volatility in markets and to any impact it may have on economies with policies like that. And suffice it to say that it'll take many months to sort this all out. Tax legislation, for example, may not be passed till next summer, and it'll take a while before markets are sure about the future for the economic growth in terms of not just 2018, but the trajectory. Will U.S. growth more permanently move higher, or will it be a 2019 Trump bump? The markets will be more interested in a permanent increase in growth, and the only way to get there is through high-quality spending, high-quality policies that encourage investments in the United States in educational attainment and in plants, equipment, software, and things that over the long run produce economic growth and have proven to be growth producers.
Just 30 seconds, we got the MOVE index measure of volatility going down. I mean, it peaked on election day, and it's been going down since.
Well, and of course, historically, the declines in volatility are something to be worried about. And I always say, beware quiet markets. One never knows what will be next. But a main goal of central bank policy, I know we're wrapping up, has been to suppress volatility, and one has to question whether central banks can continue to do that, because there has been a shift from central bank dominance to fiscal dominance now.
All right. Well, who is the guy in Bugs Bunny, the hunter, Elmer Fudd, would say markets are very, very quiet right now. Not a lot of trading going on.
Good quote, Mike.
As we get through this holiday week between Christmas and New Year's, a lot of people on vacation, but we are seeing markets higher. You get more movement off when you have volatility elevated because there are fewer people trading, but we're not seeing that so far in the markets. Tony Crescenzi is with us. He's a PIMCO market strategist and portfolio manager, which means he's all about bonds. I want to go back to something you started our conversation with earlier about how when you look at the forward curve for the bond markets, you are not seeing the enthusiasm in fixed income for Trumponomics that you are seeing in equity. I'm looking at the dot plot of the Fed, which if you go to dots.go on the Bloomberg, not only gives you the dot plot where the Fed essentially sees the proper setting of rate, the various members of the open market committee see the proper setting of rates, but you see where the market, the overnight index swaps, price out interest rates for the next couple of years. And you're right. There's no real enthusiasm for Trump boosting growth significantly over where we are right now.
Markets are quite familiar with the story on U.S. economic growth, which is to say there are very strong headwinds still, and even with the prospective changes in legislation, and there's doubts about what the, those legislative actions will do for growth on a permanent basis. Consider demographics. That's a major force in shaping the economic growth globally. It's empirically shown that it can affect growth in a nation. Consider Japan, which last year saw a decline in the number of persons, about a million in the population, from to 126 million, and the population is expected to continue contracting about a half million per year and until it goes to under 100 million in 2050. It's difficult for a nation to grow when there are fewer people to produce goods and services. In the United States, the baby boomers, people born between 1946 and 64, began turning 65, of course, that means in 2011. It's a contingent of 45 million people today that will grow to 75 million in 2029, when the last baby boomer, that includes me, will turn 65. And so the U.S. doesn't have as many people entering the labor force to produce goods and services as it used to. So when the bond market's thinking about growth prospects, it's thinking about demographic influences on growth. That's one thing. Second influence would be credit growth. Does the U.S. banking system produce the same sort of loan growth that it used to? No. So this means the impulse to growth from credit won't be as strong here in Japan and Europe as it used to be. In Europe, it had negative growth in loans through last year. Now it's up just 1.5% or so year over year. It used to grow in the high single digits. So the credit story isn't as favorable. But the biggest thing is productivity. Companies, government haven't been investing in people and in stuff. The sources of productivity are three. It's people, human capital, the skills that people bring to the table. Secondly, it's stuff. It's plants, equipment, software, infrastructure. And third, total factor productivity, they call it, how it all gets used. How do we use this stuff and people's skills? In the data, it shows that the middle part, capital intensity, it's called, the stuff part, has declined on a year-over-year basis for the first time in over 60 years. In other words, companies have fewer things in place per unit of labor, and the nation as a whole does. So a company 5 years ago that had 100 employees and 50 computers today may have, based on these data, first decline in over 60 years, 100 people and 48 computers, fewer things in place per unit of labor. And so markets, so the bond market's saying that until these things, until that changes, it can't overwhelm these other headwinds. And so why not then price in a lower than historical federal funds rate, policy rate for the Fed? And markets are priced for, Mike, you said, you looked at the dot plot and the OIS, as it's called, the markets are priced for a 2% policy rate in the year 2020. Historically, the neutral rate, where the Fed's neither pressing on the gas or the brakes, is 4.25. This is well below normal for a neutral rate. It's not even a tight rate. Remember, the Fed raised the funds rate to 5.25 the last time around, and when it raised rates from 2004 to 2006. This is a very subdued picture on growth in the bond market. So when you think Dow 20,000, take a look at the bond market and what it's priced for a few years hence.
Tony, if you look at the spread, for example, between, let's say, the 10-year bond and Treasury yields, right? So that spread has peaked for the moment. I think it widened, I'm looking, December 27 to a record 235 basis points. Can that spread become bigger next year?
It could widen, but we wouldn't expect it to widen by much. And it much depends on the viewpoint on U.S. growth and whether the view on the path for rates in the United States changes. And it depends in part on the toughness that the Fed shows toward inflation. When there's fear in the streets of the bond market needs a cop on the beat, and that cop on the beat is Janet Yellen and the Fed. Otherwise, bond market vigilantes emerge, which is to say bond investors take matters into their own hands and tighten policy for the Fed by raising rates higher than otherwise. So if the Fed is vigilant in 2017 and addresses the inflation fears developing in the bond market, that'll limit the spread between U.S. yields and foreign yields. If the Fed is tough on inflation, if it keeps controls the view on the path for rates, the destination point, which is that 2% level for 2020, then the spread will be kept low. And remember, investors globally, we know this, PIMCO has offices in 13 countries, visited many of them. Investors there are very, very keen and interested in buying bonds that are higher yielding than those in their country. And so investors in Japan and Europe will be looking to the United States to invest here if yields spreads widen. And one final point, for the Japanese investor, yields at the start of the year, switching from a 10-year JGB, Japanese government bond, to the 10-year Treasury, the pickup was about 100 basis points after including hedging costs to the Japanese investor to hedge their yen back into the dollars they buy back into yen. It went to zero in the summer. It's part of the reason why U.S. Treasury yields rose. But now it's back up to about 80, 90 basis points. So they can pick up additional incremental yield now. And so it's part of the reason for the stability in yields after the big jump in yields recently, is that the yields after hedging costs are considered for foreign investors look better. And so we're seeing again, their interest develop.
What happens for the corporate market in 2017 with the rates rising? Are we going to see borrowers step back?
You're correct, Mike. In fact, a key factor we consider in the outlook for corporate bonds is these technical factors. And because yields have increased and because companies had been expecting the possibility of a yield increase and took advantage of it by borrowing more heavily in 2016 than they otherwise would have, this means the amount of supply of corporate bonds in 2017 may decline relative to 2016 in terms of new issuance. A technical factor will be very beneficial to a corporate bond market that is of keen interest to foreign investors. And so it's one reason to stay optimistic about credit and be overweight on credit in 2017 is this technical force, and it'll remain a technical force as yields rise. One other point, in the high yield bond market, very, very few bonds mature. It's a very positive technical. In the next 3 years, under 10% of the entire universe of high-yield bonds matures because many companies have termed out their debt and pushed the debt wall maturity far out into about 2020. And so that's a positive technical that makes short-dated high-yield very attractive.
Tony, is there something, so we talk a lot about, you know, creating jobs, reflating, spending on infrastructure. Is there anything that President-elect Donald Trump can do to actually make the U.S. more productive, or at least, you know, try and fix that productivity puzzle?
Yes, for one, encourage, provide incentives to companies to invest in capital equipment that over the long run will mean more output per hour. But secondly, the spending that the U.S. engages in directly, rather than through private sources, is going to need be of high quality. So investors should focus on not just the quantity of money that is set to be spent on infrastructure, but the quality. In 2009, about $50 billion was spent on infrastructure in the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. It was felt that it was of low quality, went toward making roads nicer, but didn't really provide for more output. And also money was spent, states would otherwise have spent, so it was merely a substitution effect there. And so it's a very big challenge for the Trump administration to produce high-quality spending. Someone is going to have to watch over how the money is spent rather than how much. And that's the key to the outlook for productivity and growth and even interest rates in the future.
Tony Crescenzi of PIMCO, thanks for stopping in this morning. I know you're here to get some good Brooklyn pizza. Hope you are able to do that on your travels. This is Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio.
Who you put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? They see their role as to serve, not sell.
That's why Charles Schwab is committed to the success of over 7,000 independent financial advisors who passionately dedicate themselves to helping people achieve their financial goals. Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
All right, and now on to the tweet. Because we're always on tweet watch, right, Mike, especially when it comes to the president-elect. Now, this is his latest one. He talks about President Obama. This is after, I guess it started on Sunday. Was it Sunday, Mike, where President Obama was talking about the fact that had he been running instead of Hillary Clinton, he probably would have won again. I went back and listened to the interview twice. It was actually more thoughtful than a lot of the media portrayed it to me. Anyways, the latest Donald Trump tweet says this. It was posted a couple of minutes ago. He says, doing my best to disregard the many inflammatory President O, so President Obama, statements and roadblocks, thought it was going to be a smooth transition. Not. That's in capital letters, exclamation mark. This, again, my concern in this, Mike, is that this does not seem like a president that is trying to unify the country, right? We were talking to a guest a little bit earlier on saying we should ignore Wall Street, should not take too much notice of his tweets, but he is someone that has to, at the end of the day, govern and govern well many different political factions, and he seems at the moment a little bit thin-skinned.
A little bit. He seems rather thin-skinned, and he continues tweets. Another one coming out now, complaining about the president and his abstention on the Israel UN vote the other day. So you want to follow the president-elect, you got to get yourself a Twitter account, I guess. One of the things that Donald Trump has made very clear is that he thinks the U.S. intelligence community is not worth dealing with. He doesn't want the presidential briefings, and he says he does not trust the CIA, the DIA, and the other elements of our national security and national intelligence operations. John Nixon is a former CIA senior analyst who says that maybe Mr. Trump has a point. He's written a new book called Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. Mr. Nixon was basically the CIA's Hussein expert. And when they captured the man, they sent him in to interrogate him. And he found that much of what the agency was telling the president of the United States was wrong. Welcome to Surveillance, Mr. Nixon. You describe a CIA that does not do a particularly good job, or at least did not, around that issue.
Yes. You know, working on Iraq, we were constrained by sometimes having very bad sources of information. Overall, we understood the sort of general arc of Saddam's career and his life and what he had done. But there were many of the sort of granular details that we were in the dark about. And it was pretty shocking when I started to debrief him to learn some of these.
Do you think, John, this has changed? Has it changed? Has either the operatives or the way that communication between CIA and the president changed?
Well, unfortunately, I would say no. I think that there are still problems in terms of analysis and in collection, and some of it is not the CIA's fault. For example, you know, if you don't have a presence in a country, it's very hard to get information sometimes, and information that's good and reliable. So that's one thing. One of the things that is the CIA's fault is sometimes its analysis is very watered down, because especially in the last 10 years, I mean, the CIA has been like a piñata for policymakers to kind of take wax at, and you know, it just sort of, at that point, just sort of hunkers down and takes the blows. But the analysis itself gets kind of watered down and is not that good because the CIA doesn't want to be, you know, blamed for making mistakes. In fairness, I will say this. Intelligence is not something that is 100% right all the time. And contrary to popular opinion, we don't have a crystal ball in the basement. But, you know, we can often give policymakers a fairly good range of what might happen and what they can expect. And sometimes it's policymaker problems that really are at fault because they do think that somehow, you know, we can predict the future.
John Dixon was a senior leadership analyst with the CIA from 1998 to 2011, regularly wrote for and briefed the most senior levels of U.S. government. He's written a book about his experience in Iraq, Debriefing the President, the Interrogation of Saddam Hussein, in which he is critical of the CIA's efforts to understand what is going on in Iraq, although you are not a wholesale critic of the agency, as we were just talking about. So I'm wondering, from what we never quite know what the president-elect is thinking, but from what he has tweeted and said, do you think his distrust, dislike, and disinterest in the intelligence community is justified?
No, I think that it's very. I'm very disturbed that there is this clash that appears to be happening between the president-elect and the CIA. The irony here is that both sides need each other. The president is going to need good information in order to make decisions, and the CIA needs to have the president's trust and backing in carrying out its mission. And if a wall is, and I hate to use this metaphor for obvious reasons, but if a wall comes up between the president and his intelligence community, the only people that will benefit from that are enemies. And that's what they really would like to see happen. The thing is, the intelligence community really can, for someone like Donald Trump, who doesn't have a steep background in foreign affairs, the intelligence community actually can help him in terms of getting up to speed and understanding some of the issues that will confront him in the next 4 years. And I get nervous when I hear him say things like, well, you know, I'm a smart guy and I already know things, and I'll just, you know, if I need to hear from them, I'll ask them. You really need to be engaged in and get your briefing every day so that you can understand what's going on. It's a very complex world out there, and if you just jump into something when it's at a crisis point, you're probably not going to make the right decision. You know, if I can sort of come back to the book, that's sort of the way Saddam Hussein operated in his government. He didn't have regular briefings. He didn't have an intelligence community that was daily serving his needs. And a lot of times, when he did ask a question, he would get back the answer that they thought he wanted to hear. And, you know, he made a series of bad mistakes, chief among them the invasion of Kuwait in 1990. And, you know, something I think if Donald Trump wants to avoid derailing his presidency, he really should try to develop a relationship with the intelligence community.
John, congratulations on your book. It's a great book and also an extremely important book because of what we're talking about with the president-elect Donald Trump. But actually, in your book, right, you write that the agency, no matter who the president is, will almost want to give him the answer that he wants to hear. So actually, with the dysfunctional, or the fact that Donald Trump is now calling the agency dysfunctional, do you not see any hope that this gets severed, that actually we find a much more stable and fruitful working relationship between the president, any president, and the CIA?
That's a very good question. I'm hopeful that somehow they'll. Right now, the CIA is probably trying to figure out how best that they can serve his needs. And you know, there are things that he has said that maybe might be able to sort of get themselves in the door with him, which is, you know, he said he doesn't want to read the same thing every day. Okay, well, that's one indication. So they might not give him the same topic every day. And they also know that he wants to look at, he likes Twitter, and he probably likes his information in these small little tweet-like messages. That's unfortunate, but, you know, that might be another way to kind of communicate with him. It still remains to be seen how this gets worked out. But for all of its shortcomings, and, you know, the CIA has many shortcomings, and I chronicle some of them in the book, but the thing is, you know, you can't try to, you can't say to yourself, okay, I know what Iran is doing. I know what the Supreme Leader is up to. If you're not getting some, if you don't have some sort of grounding in the intelligence and some sort of grounding in the context and the history of what has happened before. Because if you don't do that and you say, I'm going to make decision A based on, because I'm a smart guy, it's going to be a disaster. You know, and really, can this country afford many more fiascos like Iraq? I don't think so.
Very interesting story in the Washington Post yesterday, written by a former colleague of yours, Stephen Hall, a former CIA official, why the CIA won't want to go public with its evidence of Russia's hacking. We're going to have these committees investigating, or at least maybe even one, just one super committee investigating the hacking thing. Mr. Hall makes case that, you know, anytime you give out information, you risk giving out sources and methods. And sometimes the cost of doing that is much greater than the benefit you gain from making the information public. So do you think we get anywhere with this Russian hacking investigation, anywhere that would satisfy the American people, the people who believe Donald Trump when he says it didn't happen? Can they be convinced without giving up sources and methods?
Well, I think there's a way to do that, and I think the Obama administration was correct in wanting to, you know, asking the intelligence community to look into this. Where I think the problem is that all of a sudden it gets leaked to the media before any conclusions are drawn, and then once it's in sort of into the public realm, then it becomes politicized, and it becomes sort of a football that gets kicked around by commentators and politicians and what have you, and your chances of really getting at the truth at that point become very small. And I think that that's a bad thing. The politicization of intelligence has done more, I think, to harm our foreign policy than anything in the last decade. The CIA really should just be this institution that just comes to the president and says, here are the facts. This is what we know, this is what we think we know, and this is what we don't know. But now it's sort of like you get this browbeating from the Oval Office, and then, you know, the CIA gets under pressure to kind of give the boss what he wants. And, you know, it's something that snowballs, and it has a very pernicious effect on our government and the conduct of our foreign policy.
John Nixon, former CIA senior analyst, author of the new book, Debriefing the President, The Interrogation of Saddam Hussein. And I think, Fran, it's very obvious that what happens within the intelligence community is going to be front and center in the Trump administration.
You know, it's absolutely fascinating, and it was great having John Nixon on. I wonder how much of this actually we'll find out, right? Because the CIA is always so secretive, I wonder whether Donald Trump will maybe give us more of a glimpse than previous presidents.
Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on iTunes, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm out on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Put your trust in matters. Investors have put their trust in independent registered investment advisors to the tune of $4 trillion. Why? Learn more at findyourindependentadvisor.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.